From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in downtown San Francisco.
I'm in the Mission.
Oakland, 33rd and Telegraph.
Off Piedmont Avenue.
Coming up, Bay Area schools step up to address sexual violence by examining male stereotypes.
It starts off talking about healthy masculinity, what their definition of being a man is, what they can do to demonstrate their masculinity.
Then we'll hear from Alveda King, the niece of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
I knew that my uncle was out on the forefront. I would more likely see him on the television screen than to actually see him in person.
And we'll learn the story behind this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound.
Lake Merritt Station, Lake Merritt, the only saltwater man-made lake in the nation.
Come along for the ride. It's Cross Currents. We're starting today with the latest installment of our series on public safety in the Bay Area, a project by the students in our journalism training program, the KALW Audio Academy.
What does public safety mean to you?
The city is not prepared unless everyone in the city is prepared for disaster.
So, do you owe a person sex if you've been flirting with them?
No!
It's really about stabilizing your entire life.
When it comes to talking about crimes like rape and sexual assault, the focus is shifting from prosecution and punishment to prevention. That means finding the cause of the problem and tackling it early on. Some Bay Area schools are doing just that by starting conversations with their students about healthy masculinity and what it means to be a man. The goal is to raise a different kind of man, a man who stands up against sexual violence. KLW's Lisa Bartfai tells us more.
Boys and young men today are surrounded by a lot of different ideas about how a real man should treat women. There's, for example, basketball star and family man, Stephen Curry.
I gotta start with my wife. I can't thank you enough for who you are as a person, how you challenge me, how you inspire me every single day.
But there's also poker player and Instagram star Dan Bilzerian.
I was talking to this one girl, and she's like, let's do some lap dances, whatever. I was like, look, I'm not really into all that, but I'll give you $500. You suck my...
Bilzerian and Curry are very different, but they're both straight, successful, young, rich, and have beautiful women around them. It can be confusing for young boys to figure out what kind of man they would like to be outside of those stereotypes. So sometimes adults need to step in to help them work it out. Javier Lopez leads discussion groups with high schoolers through the East Bay nonprofit Community Violence Solutions.
It starts off talking about healthy masculinity, what their definition of being a man is, what they can do to demonstrate their masculinity, and how they can create their own gender identity.
Lopez believes that certain ideas of what a man should be feed into rape culture, a phrase and idea that's lately getting a lot of attention. Lopez says rape culture can be seen in media imagery, but also in how we talk to each other.
Where we downplay sexual assault, where we downplay, violence against women. When we, you know, when young men say things like, oh, cool story, make me a sandwich to a young woman, whether they understand or not, they're perpetuating rape culture.
Lopez works hard to create a space where the young men can open up.
At first, they're a little shy, they're a little wary, they don't want to divulge as much.
He says it's really healthy for them to talk about this stuff.
Young men, they're so used to being reserved and not talking about things like that, and to talk about topics that make them uncomfortable, where they feel like they're already automatically the bad guy, so to speak, it brings up a lot of emotion for them, emotions that they're not supposed to talk about.
At East Bay School for Boys and All Boys Middle School in Berkeley, these kinds of talks are happening even earlier, in sixth grade.
A really great part of middle schoolers' minds is they're still really open-minded and open-hearted.
Dana Rosenberg is the director of curriculum at East Bay School for Boys, where she also leads the school's sex ed classes. She asks them lots of questions to help them analyze their own assumptions.
Like, what's your picture of, like, what a stereotypical man might be or act like?
Well, he might be defensive, kind of, or maybe violent.
How do you think it would be different if there were girls at the school? do you think that it would look different, or how girls would behave versus boys would behave?
If there was a girl, I feel like a lot of guys would try to like show off, like, oh, he's taking my hat, I have to beat him up to like impress a girl. Or he's like, I think a girl will think I'm cool if I take this guy's hat.
Those were eighth graders David Verdon and Henry Lawton. Rosenberg also has the boys' role play.
So sometimes I'll bring in the perspective of the girl, or I'll ask boys to role play a girl, you know, and this is like, we'll say, well, if this is a heterosexual relationship, let's assume that there's maybe a boy and a girl. And we do also role play, like if there were two boys, or if it's, you know, gender variant folks, like how is it maybe different? So we talk through scenarios.
Rosenberg says acting it out is laying the groundwork for future behavior.
If a student is doing that in middle school and they're doing that enough times, then they're building like cellular and body memory around empathy and around values, as opposed to just around cause and effect, or, you know, these kind of like reward based systems that hopefully that will impact their decision making and their ability to be more aware of a person that they're in a relationship with.
Again, Javier Lopez, who works with high schoolers.
It's baby steps. It takes a while. I'm not expecting that, you know, these kids are automatically, you know, like a switch is going to go off and they're going to, oh, I get it, finally. It's going to be a long journey for them, but at the very least that they start thinking outside of themselves.
There's a new generation of boys and young men who aren't afraid to find their own definition of what it means to be a man. One outside of the box of male stereotypes. And when it comes to preventing sexual violence, that just might be the way forward. In Berkeley, I'm Lisa Bartfei for Cross Currents.
Lisa Bartfei is a student reporter in KALW's Audio Academy. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. This week, we've been bringing you stories from the families of revolutionaries. And we conclude this series today with Alveda King, the niece of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
I remember my uncle and dad having a conversation. And I remember my uncle said, you know, she's growing up and she's going to be a beautiful young lady. You better be ready, brother, because they're going to be chasing her. And that was a kind of a family joke that my dad had a nonviolent baseball bat, and he was always on duty chasing the boys away.
Alveda King grew up in a home where conversations about spirituality and social awareness were a part of everyday life. During the civil rights era, her family home was bombed in Alabama. Over the years, King has authored books, served in Georgia's House of Representatives, and is a contributor to Fox News. She's also a minister and a pastoral associate for Priests for Life, where she says she advocates for civil rights for the unborn. KALW's Leela Day spoke with her about life as a king.
What did you call your uncle, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., when you were growing up?
One of my favorite memories of my uncle is when we were at their home on Sunset Avenue in Atlanta, Georgia. And so Uncle ML was at the piano, my dad was on the violin, and everyone was gathered together to sing. And that was a beautiful time. But we had many happy times like that.
That sounds amazing. So it sounds like your family had a lot of lively energy going on. And you also grew up in a very spiritual home. Tell me more about what that was like growing up in such a spiritual family.
Well, my granddaddy, Martin Luther King Sr., was a Baptist preacher. And during their lifetimes, his sons were co-pastors with him. They at one time were assistant pastors when they were at their youngest, and then they began to be co-pastors until their deaths. And so we had many, many Bible lessons. The strength of the Bible message from Martin Luther King Jr., Uncle ML liked to talk about the love of God and the power of forgiveness and love being stronger than hate. My dad, Reverend A.D. King, liked to talk about the miracles of Jesus. And Daddy King liked to talk about the least of these, caring for others.
Just going back to what it was like for you growing up at home with such a prominent family name, do you remember what those conversations were like, those after-dinner conversations surrounding, you know, the civil rights movement?
Throughout the 1960s, I remember not only the conversations, but the activities, and I participated in many. I went on my first march in 1963. It was called the Children's March, and that was during the time in Birmingham, Alabama, when our family home, the home of A.D. and Naomi King, the church parsonage was bombed. So I remember all of the conversations about the voting rights, about the transportation system, the things that even in the 50s, Mrs. Rosa Parks had refused to give up her seat on the bus. So not only were those matters discussed around the family tables, but in church and community meetings. And so children were highly involved.
So you basically, it sounds like this was just part of your marrow growing up, right? Was there ever a moment where you thought, I have a pretty unique family here, that I have a pretty unique mission as an individual? Or did you just think this was normal? This was just a normal childhood growing up, all these activities and these campaigns that you were involved in. How did you understand that? Yeah.
I was very aware in the 1950s and 60s. On until this day, that I am a part of a family that was called to be involved in spiritual leadership and moral leadership and civic leadership. And I was very aware that I was part of that community, but I never felt isolated and I never felt necessarily unique, because even though Martin Luther King Jr. was the leader of the movement, there were many heroes and sheroes that worked with him side by side, and there were many foot soldiers. And so we were a community of freedom fighters.
Right. And you have children as well, right?
I have, let's see, 6 living children and 10 grandchildren.
Now, with such a powerful family name, and you've taken a path to create your own legacy, do you feel that your children will have that pressure to do the same thing? Or do you struggle at all with wanting them to do their own thing, yet wanting them to have legacy or continue this family legacy as well?
We observe and watch our children as they're growing up and encourage them to pursue their dreams. We do encourage them to have a relationship with God. That is very important. But beyond that, we don't try to push or nudge any of our children in any particular direction. I was not nudged or forced into my calling. I'm an evangelist today, and the Lord called me, and I said, yes, Lord. So that was not forced. Daddy King, of course, with his sons, did want them to be preachers. And he did everything he could do to make that come to pass, and yet they became civil rights warriors. I was always taught as a child that I could be whomever and whatever I dreamed I could be.
That was Alveda King, niece of the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. She spoke with KALW's Leela Day for our series, Families of Revolutionaries. Find all of the stories at our website, kalw.org, and click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba, and now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KALW's Julie Kane.
All week long, we've been playing you this sound.
Lake Merritt Station, Lake Merritt, the only saltwater man-made lake in the nation. Lake Merritt Station, take a moment to gather up your belongings. Lake Merritt.
Okay. BART's been in the news a lot lately. Delayed and overcrowded trains, bus bridges, that kind of thing. It kind of goes with the territory for a 40-plus-year-old transit system using the country's oldest cars. And the technology in those cars hasn't changed much either. In the front of every BART train, there's a computer that drives the train. But sharing the little cabin with that computer is a person, the BART operator. They're the eyes and ears of the trains, and they're also the voice. So what's it like to operate trains that are now moving more than 4 times as many riders as when the system started? KALW's Eli Wertschafter got inside the operator's cab to bring us this story.
I feel like, you know, sometimes I put on my jumpsuit. I feel like a ground astronaut.
So I just keyed on. I'm going into automatic mode. You see the doors pop. So door open, brake on. I'm gonna turn on my radio.
Happy Monday, San Francisco Daly City Mound train now boarding.
Thank you, outbound, inbound. How you been?
So now here we go
to the Wild Blue Yonder.
Well, hello to all the listeners out there. Happy new moment. My name is Alan W. Holly. I'm a train operator, so I help move over 400,000 plus people a day safely. Maybe not always on time, but safely.
Okay, approaching downtown San Leandro. San Leandro Golf Course and Marina. Downtown San Leandro. So you feel it? We're pulling in. Can you feel like it's... Same time, I'm looking inside the platform. I'm looking underneath the platform. I'm looking on top of the platform, right? I'm monitoring. You see the little child running? Look at this. So the mother finally pays attention in, you see? So we have to pay attention for that kind of stuff. Good morning. And then, you know, I grew up here in Oakland, actually, near this Coliseum station. Being a child, I always wanted to be the bus driver or train operator because they used to, you know, as a kid, you would see them. They would take us to school, our appointments, wherever we had to go, right? They were like a staple in the neighborhood and were looked upon with a lot of respect. You're watching this, right? Because, you know, you're very few people get to actually witness this. Get to see the whole city skyline, downtown Oakland. So we're approaching the Coliseum station. Airport bound passengers exit the train, make a left turn, walk toward the trailing car, the Fremont end of the platform. Now, if you don't know your left from right, it'll be the other left. You can't just freestyle. You know, it's like giving central information. Because at any given moment, you have so many people that have never ridden BART. You know, and so we like to be, personally, I like to be reassuring. You know, maybe it's a stressful situation and they may need to go to Highland Hospital, which is off Fruitvale. Maybe there's a court date. Lake Merritt Station, you have Alameda County Superior Court, Laney College, and lovely Lake Merritt, the only saltwater man-made lake in the nation, Lake Merritt Station. 117 Central. Actually, I feel like a bird. I'm in a plane and something. I get to see things every day, you know. You see it, look. It's like an incredible view. And at the same time, I'm helping people get to where they need to go. All right, so now we're in the Transbay 2, right? Well, I take this trip twice a day, and I feel really confident with the 2. Here we go. We headed into one of my favorite part of towns, the Mission District. 24th Street in Mission, home to Dance Mission Theater, Donata's Italian Bakery, the Mission Culture Center, La Taqueria, So I know everybody don't eat meat. I'll cut back on meat, but if you want one of the best steak tacos, go get the crunchy steak taco, right? Right next door to desserts. Ah. As we head to Daly City, you're gonna look to the right and you're gonna see, wow, it's like you can see the ocean. Well, you know, we as Americans, we used to pushing the button and boom, getting it instantly, right? And even with the aging system, we do the best we can with what we have, and it's working. If you depend on public transportation, be patient, you know, have a book, Duolingo, something to read, or draw, something. But just be patient, because a lot of times when we're delayed, we don't know why. We don't know the reason. But it might be to, you know, meet your mate or to cross paths with somebody that's meant for you to meet.
Happy Monday. Daly City Station.
Boom, I hit the stop button.
5 good cars outbound, it's all yours.
Thanks, Alan. Now, I know this week's sound seemed easy. A BART announcement, right? But only one of you knew who was making that announcement, and that is Sharon Robinson. She totally recognized Alan's voice. Congratulations, Sharon. We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. We're going to go on a little break for KALW's spring membership campaign, but we'll be bringing you all new audiograph sounds when we come back. Until then, keep your ears open, and if you have an idea for where we should record next, give us a call, 415-264-7106. We love hearing from you. And now, approaching the end of the show, I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks, Julie. So if you're an audiograph fan and you really, really try hard to solve these every week, well, you definitely need to subscribe to our podcast. You can hear audiographs, catch up on past episodes of Cross Currents. It is all there at kalw.org/subscribe. And here are some folks who are definitely audiograph fans. Our team. Shireen Adil, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ian Lewis, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Raja Shah, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Julie Kane. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our news director is Ben Trefney. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by a 7-piece band from San Francisco called The Session. They perform a free show at Yerba Buena Gardens Saturday afternoon, and it starts about 1 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.